Maybe 2 a.m., Roy of Hollywood was on, right? And he was playing Alan Watts. And it was so surreal. I was like, what is this? What is this? What kind of radio is this? You know? I mean, it just blew my mind. And I got hooked right away.
KPFK.
90.7 KPFK, Los Angeles.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman and happy to be back with you just in time for the inauguration of A Nightmare to Come. But Los Angeles is already in a post-apocalyptic nightmare with twin firestorms that have wiped out Pacific Palisades and much of Altadena. More than ever, we miss the sagacity of Mike Davis, who died in October 2022. But in October 2020, Mike was invited to give the annual lecture at UMass Amherst's Feinberg Family Distinguished Lecture Series, moderated by Vijay Prashad. October, as Southern Californians know, is the month of the Santa Ana winds, and Mike began his lecture talking about the 4 million acres of forest burned in what he called the fire year from hell, an almost unimaginable ordeal, in his words, though the Santa Ana winds had not yet begun to blow like dry hurricanes. Though Mike couldn't imagine the burning of downtown Altadena or the destruction of the Palisades, Mike knew the outline of the firestorms and disasters to come, and he begins his lecture with his favorite Ward Moore's 1947 sci-fi novel that describes the nightmare Devilgrass, the monstrous new nature swallowing up everything in its path, replacing native land cover, and creating the flammable understory of our fires. Let's hear from Mike.
Mike Davis, welcome to the Feinberg series.
Thank you so much, Vijay. And thanks to the History Department and Mr. Feinberg for inviting me to give this talk. I'm speaking from California, of course, which so far this year, 4 million acres of forest has burnt in really what is the fire year from hell. And we're only halfway through it. We're not yet in the midst of the part of the season where the Santa Ana winds blow like dry hurricanes. So we're hardly out of this. It's been an almost unimaginable ordeal. In a 1947 novel by the left-wing sci-fi writer Ward Moore, a madwoman scientist in LA, one Josephine Francis, recruits a down-and-out salesman, Albert Wiemer, described as having, quote, all the instincts of a roach, to help promote her discovery, a compound called the metamorphosizer that enhances the growth of grasses and allows them to thrive on barren and rocky terrains. She dreams of permanently ending world hunger through a massive expansion of the range of wheat and other grains. Wiemer, a scientific ignoramus, thinks only of making a quick buck, peddling the stuff door to door as a long treatment. Desperately needing cash to consider her research, Francis reluctantly agrees, and Wiemer heads out to the yellowed lawns of tired bungalow neighborhoods. To surprise, the treatment, which alters grass genes, works only too well. In the yard of the Dinkman family, crabgrass is converted into a nightmare devil grass, resistant to mowing and weed killers, that begins to spread across the city. Quote, it writhed and twisted in nightmarish unease, inexorably enveloping everything in its path. A crack in the roadway disappeared under it. A shrub was swallowed up. A patch of wall vanished. It continues to eat pavements and houses and finally consumes the city itself, a monstrous new nature creeping toward Bethlehem. Greener Than You Think is both hilarious and slightly unnerving, but in the strangest of turns, its absurd premises are being turned into reality by climate change. Devilgrass is actually bromus, a tribe of invasive and almost ineradicable weeds bearing appropriately unsavory names such as ripgut brome, cheatgrass, and false brome. Its sinister allies from other tribes include the scourges of Medusa head, tall fescue, and barbed goatgrass. In a first wave of plant invasion, black mustard and oatgrass arrived from Europe in the Spanish period, and thanks to overgrazing by wild cattle, soon replaced native perennial grasses. The bromes, originating in the eastern Mediterranean and the Middle East, came as the second wave in the 1880s. They were described as a contagion that ate away at the endless carpet of wildflowers, whose spring displays in the foothills and valleys had stunned early visitors and put golden in the state's nickname. But now, increased fire frequency and exurban sprawl have become brome's new metamorphosizers as they rapidly conquer and degrade ecosystems throughout the state. The eastern Mojave Desert is a tragic example. En route from LA to Vegas and about 20 minutes from the state line, there's an exit from I-15 to a two-lane blacktop called Sima Road. It's the unassuming portal to one of North America's most magical forests, countless miles of old-growth Joshua trees mantling a field of small Pleistocene volcanoes known as Sima Dome. The monarchs of the forest are 45 feet high and centuries old. In mid-August, an estimated 1.3 million of these astonishing giant yuccas perished in the lightning-ignited dome fire. This is not the first time that the eastern Mojave burned. A megafire in 2005 scorched 1 million acres of desert, but it spared the dome, the very heart of the ecosystem. Over the last generation, episodic invasions of red brome have created a flammable understory to the Joshuas and transformed the Mojave into a fire ecology. Most desert plants, unlike California oaks and chaparral, are not fire adapted, so the recovery may be impossible. Deborah Hewson, the chief scientist at the Mojave National Preserve, indeed described the fire as an extinction event. The Joshua, she says, are very flammable. They'll die and they won't come back. Our burning deserts are regional expressions of a global trend. The fire-driven transformation and replacement of native land cover from Greenland to Hawaii, even the Antarctic Peninsula, now has an invasive weed problem. In most cases, exotic plants, especially annual grasses and forbs, are the culprits. In the east southeastern U.S., the devil is Kangen grass from Southeast Asia, in Australia, buffle grass from India, in Hawaii, guinea grass from Africa, and in Spain, Epinonymus mauritanian grass. But brome superbly adapted to the Anthropocene rule the West Coast. As Travis Bean, a weed scientist at UC Riverside, warned last year, we have all of the nasty non-native Broma species here in California, and the ubiquitous weeds are the key drivers of increasing fire frequency. Increased fire frequency, in turn, opens new spaces for the propagation of these fast-growing and easily dispersed species. When recovering mountain chaparral, for instance, requires 20 years before it matures enough to burn, bromes need only one or two winters' rain to reduce enough flammable biomass to sustain large fire. And once established, the ensuing invasive grass fire cycle is almost irreversible. This is happening in all the Mediterranean biomes, despite the fact that their vegetation has similarly co-evolved with fire and requires the current wave of annual extreme fire in the Iberian Peninsula, Greece, Australia, and California is overriding Holocene adaptations and pushing native ecosystems, many of them already degraded, past their survival tipping points. Southern California's coastal sage scrub, for instance, is estimated to have lost 68% of its area to bromes and other invading weeds. Although Australia is a close contender, it is California which best illustrates the vicious circle, where extreme heat leads to frequent extreme fires that prevent natural regeneration, and with the help of tree diseases, accelerate the conversion of iconic landscapes into parched grasslands and treeless mountain slopes. And with the loss of native plants goes much of the native fauna, from salamanders to owls. Now, climate change drives landscape conversion in several different ways. From an Earth systems perspective, the warming of the equator is expanding the Hadley cell, the vast system of overturning circulation that pumps hot, moist air upwards, producing tropical rainfall. Then the same air masses descend in the semi-tropics as high pressure ridges blocking rainfall and creating most of the world's deserts and arid lands. According to cutting-edge climate modeling from Columbia University's Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory, the impact on lower latitude temperate landscapes such as California will be profound. Quote, the ongoing climate change and future change, if it follows model projections, will transform and move Mediterranean-type climate regions. At the core latitudes of the regions, aridity will increase as winters become drier and temperatures increase throughout the year. On the equatorward flank, some locations that are currently Mediterranean-type climates are likely to transition into subtropical desert or subtropical steppe. Quote, this is likely the future of Southern California. On the other hand, Mediterranean climate will probably move poleward into Oregon and even Washington, threatening many forests. Anthony Westerlin at UC Merced believes this transition is now fully in progress, and that explains the recent epidemic of extreme fire north of San Francisco. Climate change, he says, is giving Northern California a climate like Southern California in terms of the degree of drying that fuels undergo. Indeed, state water planners and fire authorities since the turn of the century have been intensely focused on the threat of multi-year droughts caused by intensified La Niña episodes and stubbornly persistent high pressure dumps, both of which can be attributed to anthropogenic warming. They've also anticipated that the drying of forests would increase vulnerability to insect infestations and tree diseases. Their worst fears were realized in the great drought of the last decade, the biggest since the 16th century, which contributed to the death of more than 100 million bark beetle-infested trees, which subsequently provided fuel mass for the firestorms of 2017 and 2018. At the same time, an exponentially spreading fungal pandemic called sudden oak growth, which is also facilitated by drought, has killed hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of live oaks and tan oaks in the coast ranges from Big Sur to southwestern Oregon. Since the tan oaks especially grow in mixed forests with Douglas firs, redwoods, ponderosa pines, their dead hulks should probably be accounted as million-barrel fuel oil equivalents in the current firestorms raging in the coastal mountain Sierra foothills. The 28 fires still ongoing. In addition to ordinary dry droughts, however, scientists now talk about a new phenomenon in California, a hot drought. Even in years with average 20th century rainfall, extreme summer heat, our new normal, is beginning to produce massive water deficits through evaporation in reservoirs, streams, and rivers. In the case of Southern California's lifeline, the Lower Colorado River, a staggering 20% decrease in the current flow has been predicted within a few decades, independent of whether or not watershed precipitation declines. But the most devastating impact of Death Valley-like temperatures was 121 degrees within LA city limits out in the San Fernando Valley recently. So a wet winter and early spring may mesmerize us with extravagant displays of wildflowers, but they also produce bumper crops of grasses and herb-like plants that are then baked in our furnace summers to become fire starters when the devil winds return. The bromes and other pyromaniacal weeds like black mustard, pampas grass, and French broom are the chief byproducts and facilitators of this new fire regime. Years of research at experimental plots where scientists burn different types of vegetation and study their fire behavior has confirmed their Darwinian edge. They burn at twice the temperature of herbaceous ground cover, volatilizing soil nutrients essential to the regeneration of native species, whereas the historical fire season for the state's major savanna and chaparral species, plants like oak, chemise, manzanita sage, and buckwheat, is 6 months long. The invasive bromes can burn almost any time during the year. A study published last year by the National Academy of Sciences estimated that the invasive grasses are already increasing fire occurrence by up to 230% and fire frequency by up to 150%. They also have a formidable capacity to alter soil conditions in their favor. According to UC Riverside researchers, invaders, quote, accelerate the onset of summer drought and decrease deep soil water recharge, inhibiting the reestablishment of native shrubs and further increasing vulnerability to invasion. In addition, they sponsor the growth of microbial communities inimical to endemic plants, especially those that constitute Southern California's coastal sage shrub ecosystem. As a result, weeds replace, often permanently, the woody native shrubs that provide net carbon storage. This ecosystem conversion, warned scientists back in 2006, has changed portions of the western U.S. from a carbon sink to a carbon source, making previous estimates of a western carbon sink almost certainly spurious. Now, annual firestorms kindled by weed growth are overwhelming the state's highly advertised efforts at curbing greenhouse emissions. In the 7 weeks from the beginning of August of this year to mid-September, megafires in California had released significantly more carbon dioxide, 91 million metric tons, than produced by all the cars, cities, and industries in the states the previous year. One fire alone, a 200,000-acre fire in Northern California, produced the equivalent of the annual emissions of 2.7 million cars. And weeds, as weeds do, can pop up literally everywhere. It was once believed that mountain chaparral was invulnerable to the brome threat, but today the wild grasses have taken over one-third of the surface area. Chaparral is adapted to intense burns within a range of 20 to 50 years, but high fire frequency, 1 to 15 years, ensures the dominance of invasive species and a type conversion to grasslands. Likewise, closed canopy West Coast forests have never seemed threatened because they're too cool and shaded. But a research group at Oregon State's College of Forestry that is studying the question now warns forest managers that the species called false brome actually adapts well to forest gloom, while cheatgrass immediately colonizes forest burn sites. Once a durable feedback loop with fire is established, a forest grass invasion becomes, in their words, a perfect storm. And like Wiemer's devil grass, the invaders repel almost all attempts at extermination. Management actions, write the Oregonians, such as thinning and prescribed fire, often designed to alleviate threats to wildfire, may also exacerbate grass invasion and increase fine fuels, with potential landscape consequences that are largely under-recognized. UCLA's John Keeley, a world-renowned expert on fire in California's ecosystems, made the same point a couple years earlier. Quote, complete clearance can actually enhance fire spread by both increasing alien weeds that comprise flashy fuels and by eliminating important ember catchers such as oak trees that can dampen the fire threat around homes. In any event, clearance by itself affords little or no protection, Last year, Keeley and his colleague Alexander Sippert published the first major survey of homes destroyed by the fires of the last decade. And they arrived at the surprising finding, quote, that if the structures that did have more than 30 meters of defensible space, the vast majority were destroyed in the fires. In other words, the textbook prescriptions for reducing fire hazards may only reproduce them in a new form, something that is poorly understood, if at all, by public officials. This is the true Achilles heel of the emergency legislation that Dianne Feinstein, with the support of Governor Newsom, is trying to push through Congress. It would override all environmental regulations to accelerate the thinning of forests and the clearance of chaparral and brush. The bulldozers and torches would invite roams into cleared landscapes without factoring in their ability to annually generate large fuel loads. Only a sustained annual effort to reseed native plants and remove to the extent possible the bromes and their friends, something that would require a large army of full-time forest workers and the cooperation of landowners, could theoretically postpone the weed apocalypse. And let me note, I just received a book this morning that I ordered on California invasive plants. And when it comes to red brome, which is the grass that ignited the eastern Mojave, the recommendation is, at all costs, don't burn. That will just accelerate its growth. Well, what are the alternatives, according to this handbook used by ecologists and fire prevention workers? Handpicking may do it. Can you imagine plucking out weeds from hundreds of thousands of California grasslands and the hillsides? Dealing with the threat would also require a moratorium on new construction as well as post-fire rebuilding in the most extreme fire hazard areas. But this is hardly palatable in Sacramento, even in the era of a Democratic supermajority in the legislature. Governor Newsom and other liberal leaders address every fire emergency as the result of climate change and call for urgent action to reduce emissions. In doing so, they deliberately elide the question of what needs to be done on the ground, here and now. Such an agenda would have to directly confront the continuing dictatorship of land-extensive real estate development, especially the sprawl along what fire experts call the Wildland-Urban Interface, the WUI. The Forest Service definition of this distinguishes between two conditions. Interface is when suburban housing is near wildland vegetation, as in the Coffee Park subdivision of Santa Rosa, destroyed by the 2017 Tubbs fire. Intermixed, on the other hand, describes the intermingling of housing with brush and trees, the case with many homes in the dune town of Paradise, incinerated in the 2018 Camp Fire. A majority of new housing over the last 20 years in California has been built profitably but insanely in such fire ecologies. And by one estimate, over a quarter of the state's population, 11 million people, now live in the WUI. Moreover, the juggernaut, despite the firestorm, seems almost unstoppable. According to a 2018 report by Bloomberg Businessweek, quote, an estimated 1 million new homes in California will be built in California's high-risk wildfire zones by 2050. In San Diego County, where I live, supervisors recently approved 10,000 new homes in what's officially called extreme fire hazard locations. This exponential increase in the fire hazard because of exurbanization can be illustrated by a recent Northern California example, the Tubbs fire that destroyed part of Santa Rosa. Quote, in 1964, the Hanley fire in Sonoma County destroyed fewer than 100 homes. Last fall, speaking about 2017, the Tubbs fire, which covered almost the same ground, destroyed more than 5,000 homes and killed 22 people. Now, since 40% of the state's 33 million acres of forest are privately owned, 57% is federal land. So when Trump comes to California and blames the state for poor forest management, well, most of that forest is federal land, and the last I heard, he was still head of the federal government, so it's on his dime this has occurred. Only about 3% is actually controlled by the state or local governments as parks and so on. So there are few restraints on future development within the 40% privately owned land without forceful legislative action. But attempts over the years to do this, even in the most modest ways, imposing a $150 fee on exurban homes to pay for local fire services, or attempts to introduce some form of fire zoning, have been vetoed by previous governors, Schwarzenegger and then Jerry Brown. And Newsom himself recently vetoed a bill that would have required local governments to restrict burning permits in, quote, very high fire risk areas, quote, to only those homes that met the new fire and prevention standards detailed in the bill. Now, the uncontrolled expansion of the residential frontier into disaster-prone landscapes, of course, isn't just a California trend. Think about the building boom on the Atlantic and Gulf Coast barrier islands, episodically submerged in hurricane storm surges. According to geographers Laura Taylor and Patrick Hurley, quote, despite the common perception that the U.S. has become a suburban nation, exurbia has emerged as the dominant settlement pattern across the country, characterized by different patterns of development and different lifestyle expectations from cities, towns, and suburbs, with houses in scenic natural areas on relatively large acreages, often with one house per 10, 20, 40 acres or more. So instead of densifying housing in the footprints of older suburbs, especially near rapid transit, which is the rational approach to the national housing affordability crisis, market forces are poaching the wildlands and increasing car dependency while shifting the costs of wildfire protection onto county, state, and federal governments. But there are two very different migration streams, talking about California. Some, like the inhabitants of Paradise, the Sierra foothills city consumed by a firestorm in 2018, are rent refugees from the state's housing crisis, or ordinary folks, especially retirees, who want to own a tiny piece of the state's beauty. Many live in trailers or manufactured homes, blending in with the traditional low-income rural populations in the shadow of declining extractive industries. But they're minor players compared with the influx of wealth from the coast. Rural areas were once ruggedly blue-collared and derided as Appalachia, the insult long attached to eastern San Diego County, where I grew up, now boast, quote, starter castles, high-end subdivisions and spa retreats, from Mendocino on the north coast to the Sierra Mountains in the south. Upper 5% migration has been gentrifying the urban hinterlands, especially those areas with high amenity values such as ocean views, wineries, forest lakes, or colorful local histories. Increasing numbers are second and weekend or weekend homes, affordable by those who have a solid anchor in soaring coastal home equity. An equally prized, if unspoken, amenity is the racial homogeneity. Exurbanization is often a euphemism for white flight from metropolitan diversity. California's high-income exurbs, regardless of their politics, are almost entirely monochromatic. Nevada County, one of the fastest-growing Sierra exurbs, is just 0.4% Black, while more liberal Mendocino County is 0.7%. As California's suburbs turn to technicolor and become more democratic, the population in the wildland-urban interface, especially inland from the coast, trends hardcore conservative and fiercely anti-government, except in fire season. One of their leading voices was Duncan Hunter Jr., and before that, his father, also Duncan Hunter. Duncan Hunter Jr. is now on his way from Congress to prison. he's represented, the hunters have represented the exurban corridor along I-15 from San Diego to Temecula. For years, the hunters fought endangered species legislation and restrictions on backcountry development with the same zeal they opposed Latino immigrants and affirmative action. The hunters were the first to advocate denying citizen rights, birth citizen rights, to babies whose parents were undocumented. Now, this is a mindset blind to the consequences that allies itself to the botanical counter-revolution. Relentless land clearance and home construction fragment habitats, introduce myriad new emission sources, and promote weed invasion. Yet the newcomers in the majority are unwilling to accept state enforcement of building material codes or proposed fire zoning regulations, and they raise hell when foresters attempt prescribed burns. A recent report from the National Bureau of Economic Research targeted the perversity of using general tax to provide fire protection to all of the exurbanites who take so little responsibility for their own safety. Quote, the very fact that firefighting is publicly funded decreases the incentive for WUI residents to fireproof their property, distorting the housing market further and creating moral hazard. I continue, because much of the firefighting budget comes out of federal disaster relief funds, publicly funded fire response decreases the incentive for a city or state, hello California, to create and enforce wildland building codes. Meanwhile, undermanned fire crews are under tremendous pressure to defend individual home sites, making it almost impossible to adhere to the Forest Service doctrine of, quote, disengaging suppression activities immediately if strategies and tactics cannot be implemented safely. And the result is, I'm constantly reminded by my ex-brother-in-law, with whom I remain good friends. He's a retired county fire captain. Firefighters have perished trying to defend homes that are just out in the middle of the brush or the chaparral or on mountaintops. And he and all of his comrades on the county fire force are obviously very upset about this and see nothing but continuing casualty lists in the future. After fire, moreover, most exurbanites seem incapable of drawing the obvious lessons. In 2003, a firestorm, the Cedar Fire, destroyed over 1,000 homes in the unincorporated towns of Alpine and Crest in the mountains east of San Diego, near where I grew up. When I took a documentary film crew last year to this area, the lost homes had been replaced by even larger houses, and residents assured us that thanks to brush clearance, the fire hazard had been mitigated. Despite their own experiences, they had bought into the idea of defensible space and the illusion that evacuation would no longer be necessary. 3 years ago, I wrote an article, and I pointed to the example of a little community called Carve Acre in eastern San Diego County. Big homes built the end of a one-lane road surrounded by chaparral. And I wrote that even driving up that road in dry, hot summer, fire season conditions sent chills up my back. And not surprisingly, 3 years later, Carve Acre just burnt in a fire called the Valley Fire. Now, the stay-and-defend approach, which developers advocate and homeowners seem to accept, has effectively privatized disaster prevention and management by shifting fire safety responsibility to homeowners and private contractors, making it popular amongst developers and insurance companies seeking to defend property. But as we've seen from Keeley and Sippard's research, firestorms that create their own tornadic weather systems and can hurl fiery debris a mile ahead of the flame front are not deterred by 300-foot circumference of brush clearance or some carefully watered beds of ice plant. Nor can so-called fireproof homes resist combustion when extreme heat blows out their windows and ignites their garage doors. So finally, how should we understand the large-scale ecological consequences, the invasive grass wildfire cycle. One perhaps surprising analog is the aftermath of the firebombing of Germany during the Second World War. In the late 1940s, the ruins of Berlin became a laboratory where naturalists studied plant succession in the rubble. Their expectation was that the original vegetation of the region, oak woodlands and their shrubs, would soon gradually reestablish themselves. To their surprise, that was not the case. Instead, escaped exotics, some of them rare garden ornamentals, established themselves at the dominance within a new ruderal ecosystem. As one startled but fascinating researcher emphasized, quote, "The unexpected spread of foreign species made possible by the destruction of broad areas of Berlin was such a radical event that it rendered previous work on the floor of the city completely insufficient. The botanists, who until 1961, including naturalists from the Eastern Zone, continued their studies until the last major rubble site, the Dornbirn-Dreecke, which had become the most, quote, most intensively studied ecosystem within a city that had ever existed, was cleared despite loud protests for hotel construction in 1986. The repopulation of rubble, wrote another naturalist, created in many cities due to the activity of bombers in the last World War, has unintentionally become, and this is underlined, tremendous national experiment, which with respect to its size must be compared to the populating of new habitats created by volcanic activity. The persistence of this dead zone vegetation for a generation after the war and the failure of the plants of the Pomeranian woodlands to reestablish themselves prompted a debate about something called Nature Too. The emergent consensus was that the extreme heat of incendiaries and the pulverization of brick structures had created a new soil type that invited colonization by rugged plants that had evolved in the moraines of Pleistocene ice sheets, if not at the edges of lava flows. The final velociraptor in the Berlin rubble was the evil-smelling Chinese tree of heaven, Ailanthus, one of the most aggressive and ineradicable tree weed species on Earth, superbly adapted to every sort of human landscape disturbance, from 1,000-pound bombs to freeways. And today in California, you can find tree of heaven almost everywhere, sprouting from cracked asphalt in LA, parking lots, colonizing foothill stream beds, and so on. Now imagine, an all-out nuclear war would reproduce Berlin year zero conditions and replacement ecology on a vast scale. According to a 1960 government study, quote, "Under certain conditions, ultimate spread of fires from one nuclear weapon has been estimated to be as great as 10,000 square miles. And to model such firestorms, Army and Forest researchers in the early 1960s studied recent fires in the Santa Monica Mountains as analogs for nuclear fire. They're particularly interested in the energy intensity of wildfires in various environments, establishing a precedent for calculating fire energy in terms of tonnage of TNT. Now, in the aftermath of Victoria's Black Sunday fires in early 2009 that killed 173 people, Australian scientists calculated that the released energy equaled the explosion of 1,500 Hiroshima-sized bombs. Even greater energy has produced the pyrocumulus plumes that for weeks have towered over Northern California and Southern Oregon. In fact, the toxic orange smog that has shrouded the Bay Area might be considered a miniature nuclear winter. Mega fires in the Anthropocene, in other words, can easily be seen as the physical equivalents of nuclear war without fallout. As a result, a new, profoundly sinister second nature is rapidly emerging from our fire rubble at the expense of landscapes we once considered as sacred. Weeds and weedy species of all kinds will continue to win victories within the new evolutionary spaces opened by climate change. Our imaginations can barely encompass the speed or scale of the catastrophe. Gone, California, gone.
Mike Davis, gone, California, gone. What an ending. I think a lot of people are wondering, is California gone? Are people going to pack their cars into a reverse dust bowl, drive back to the American South or to the Midwest from whence their ancestors came, or perhaps get on a plane and fly to Asia or somewhere else, buying oceanfront property in southern Arizona? I mean, is California finished?
The point that I've tried to make in this talk, in many articles and talks I've given recently about fire, is simply this. Climate change is bringing about major irreversible transformations in vegetation and fauna. And while we can certainly do things to mitigate fire conditions, it's impossible for us to change that fact. And that's a worldwide fact. Whether it's peatlands in eastern Siberia, whether it's the Fertile Crescent, which scientist Lamont Doherty will tell you isn't the Fertile Crescent anymore because of climate change, a fact that has contributed to an exodus of rural people in the Middle East, become a major factor in the wars of the region, whether it's in the Caribbean, which will suffer massive drying, as well as Central America, where drought refugees from Honduras are already camped out 12 miles away from where I speak, in shantytowns in Tijuana, trying to desperately cross the border of the U.S. All this is the reality that our world system and mode of production have brought upon us. And, of course, there are things we can do, but we have to accept the kind of damage that is now built in and absolutely unavoidable.
You know, it reminds me of Mahmoud Mamdani's book on Darfur, where he argued that a point that has been neglected in the uproar around the attacks in Darfur is the desiccation of the Sahara. I mean, the Sahel region and the creeping southward of the Sahara. You know, I've seen that personally in Niger and in Chad, and you just see, you know, agriculture becoming impossible. A lot of your talk and a lot of what is happening in the Sahel region of Africa reminds me of Alfred Crosby's book, Ecological Imperialism. The sense that these are just things we're going to have to learn to deal with, that we've crossed a barrier. There's a lot of people asking questions, you know, what should we do? Should we have well-timed grazing to manage invasive bromes and things like that? I mean, you used the word just now saying you can mitigate things, but you can't reverse the tide. I want you to say that again in a way that is clear to people.
Well, the big question, of course, is who has the power or resource to mitigate? And obviously, the poorest quarter of humanity doesn't have those resources. That's the part of humanity that lives in countries that have contributed only minuscule amounts of greenhouse gases that stand in the way of the most catastrophic effects, particularly in agriculture. The Indus Valley is the largest irrigation system in the world, supporting 70 to 90 million people. I forget how many. And it's in great danger from the early melting of glaciers and snowpacks. And it's hard to find a region in the world except for Canada, which will see a great northern expansion of agriculture and trees will move north, that isn't in the crosshairs. The problem is that the countries and the rich classes in those countries that are responsible for opposing and preventing effective action on climate change, they have no rational actor incentive to aid the poor. So built into all of this is a kind of incipient genocide. And we see it all around us. Like I say, 12 miles from me is the border fence to repel people who have no choice but to leave their traditional homes in the search of food, water, and employment. And the Iron Curtain has been replaced by a great wall of capitalism everywhere. I mean, look at Australia, Fortress Australia, the concentration camps it's built on Papuan Islands, and so on. That's why I believe that in all things, we have to act in name of the unity of the human race and in the name of what's necessary, not what's realistic or seems possible at the present. And this is a consciousness, I believe, that deeply permeates the generation that my younger children belong to and their friends all around the world. Meanwhile, older generations in the United States and Europe and elsewhere live by the principle of consuming all the good things of the earth in their lifetime and leaving nothing behind. I think that we're set on a terminal course right now. People who believe that, well, Biden will be elected and democratic capitalism will get its act together and we'll go back to a new period of growth and happiness. I mean, this is a foolish illusion at best, at a time when low-wage workers in this country, I mean, they went to bed in March of this year. It's 2001. They woke up the next morning and looked out the window. It's 1933, and that's unlikely to change.
You know, Walter Benjamin had a beautiful line where he said the socialist imagination isn't to make the train of society go faster, but to pull hard at the handbrake. You know, that insight seems more and more prescient. As you said, getting growth started might be exactly part of the problem. You know, part of the solution might lie in changing everything. I mean, I happen to know your daughter. She's a very sensitive person, a book editor, a reader, somebody who likes ideas. This is the kind of generation that's coming up, sensitive people who are not interested necessarily in being vacuum cleaners of the planet's resources. Think a little bit with me about this idea of socialism as pulling up the handbrake rather than accelerating the train.
Well, I think, first of all, we need to be more precise about what socialism is. Socialism is the democratization of economic power and investments, the power that's now invested in, say, the 500 largest corporations in the world that control our fate in so many, many different ways. And I was a little bit critical of the Occupy movement because the stress was almost entirely on income inequality rather than the question of economic power, of, for instance, nationalizing the banks, of which there was a real opportunity in 2008. And you didn't even need to be a socialist to believe in this. Ireland temporarily nationalized their banks. There have been many opportunities to expand public ownership and democratize public institutions that weren't taken. But the big question that you're asking has kind of haunted the environmental left for a long time. How can we guarantee to every person on this planet a high quality of existence, given that the footprint of industrial capitalism or state socialism exceeds the care of the planet? I think that's how some people would describe it. And I wrote something once called Who Will Build the Ark? And it's a solution lies in the socialization of consumption and in the city, real cities, not suburbanized cities like American cities. I mean, on a typical campus, students, including married graduate students, live very modestly in a shared room or an apartment, a small house. But look at the social infrastructure for recreation, knowledge, and human interaction around them. Magnificent swimming pools, athletic facilities, great libraries. And what to the utopian socialist Charles Fourier was most important, high degrees of promiscuity. Fourier defined promiscuity as the intimacy of strangers. So easy to be in love on a campus, and so much harder to be isolated than it is for single poor people, aging people in most American cities. By embracing this kind of model, which was the subject of an intense debate and experimental practice from William Morris in the 1880s down through the Russian constructivists and Red Vienna in the 1920s, trying to create an alternative urbanism built upon socialized consumption and public affluence. I mean, even in the grim conditions of the 1920s in the Soviet Union, when people were crammed in often two families in a single apartment, and the means for transforming residential life were very slim, the constructivists built these workers' palaces, you know, cinemas, sports facilities, libraries, and so on, next to every large factory. And they were magnificent. They were the kind of Notre Dames of a socialist regime. So I believe that ultimately there's no real contradiction against everyone on this planet's rights to a meaningful social role in employment and to the things that are necessary in life. There's no reason we can't guarantee this. The environmentalists have been wrong about this all along. And of course, there's a hardcore of them who embrace the simply Malthusian version that those people who are in the lifeboats stay in it and we can't take anybody else aboard. That is an almost neo-fascist mentality.
It's also not true because, you know, we know the UN Food and Agriculture Organization has told us there's enough food on the planet, and yet almost 3 billion people are hungry. They're hungry because they don't have money, not because there's not enough food. And I'm very sensitive to what you said, Mike, about rethinking ways in which we live and our personal ambitions for how we want to live. Because I think this is what people around the planet, many by dint of, you know, compulsion, have to think about, because more and more people are losing their jobs permanently in the pandemic, and their way of life, their quality of life is deteriorating. It's going to be, you know, very easy to convince people to rethink what life should be when your life is deteriorating so rapidly. It seems to me this is a perfect time to talk again about these broad questions about how we should organize things. I mean, what you talked about, the real estate market in California, for instance, and the way in which people want to defend their houses at the edge of where it's impossible to live, that is not only, of course, the problem. The problem is much graver than that, which is that the ambitions that capitalism has provided people outstrip our capacity to live as species on the planet Earth.
I mean, look, capitalism can no longer create meaningful social occupations for people with income sufficient to a decent standard of living. We know that the majority of the urban workforces of South America and Africa and in some parts of South Asia are informal workers, which is a kind of euphemism for structural unemployment, getting by the best they can. That number is increasing dramatically. And even in the so-called new industrial countries, the NICs of 10 or 15 years ago, because they turned mainly to commodity exports to China, their industries have shrunk. Sao Paulo, instead of the booming industrial center it once was, shows signs of becoming a rust belt. So the system no longer needs us to exploit us. And it, in a sense, makes a large part, minority of humanity, kind of surplus the requirements of accumulation on a global scale. Capitalism is incapable, or private medicine and big pharma is incapable, of translating revolutionary advances in biological design into public health. Capitalism, in the current model of agriculture, cannot bring about the 50% increase in grain production that the AFO has argued for years is necessary to feed the population in mid-century. One of the great unasked questions in the debates, of course, is nuclear disarmament, which is almost totally marginalized and forgotten. Yet it seems almost inevitable that we'll see at least a regional nuclear exchange within the next generation. But at each crucial point, human survival is directly put in put in question by the concentration of economic power and by the use of nationalism to manipulate the masses. So I think you're absolutely right. And I think my youngest daughter and her brother are still in high school, absolutely right. They only want to talk about radical change. They don't have time for anything else. They won't buy into any incremental So we need to return to the train of the kind of radical imagination of creating a new civilization, which was done in parts experimental, but it was done. And for 50 years, anarchists, socialists, and others dreamt that dream and tried to make it real. So I think anything short of a utopian imagination is a kind of treason to the future right now.
We're going to end in about a minute. I wanted to add to your list, of course, the Cuban doctors of the Henry Reeve Brigade, who I hope very much will win the Nobel Peace Prize for their work, you know, in trying to quell not only this virus, but the other one you've written about, Ebola and so on.
Do you know where the Cubans, they went to 18 countries to provide medical relief after the start of the pandemic. And one of the countries they went to is Andorra, a country that's mainly known to stamp collectors, I think, the Pyrenees, this tiny little country. Had a terrible coronavirus spread. And they asked their masters, the French and Spanish governments, to help them out. They wouldn't. The Cubans went to Andorra. They'll go anywhere where people need them.
The Cubans are the best. Mike Davis, this has been an incredible hour. And you end The Monster Enters with a line I want to read as a way to close out our event. You say, now with a real monster at our door, and I'm not just thinking about COVID-19, I'm thinking about the California forest fires, I'm thinking about the pandemic of hunger and poverty and so on. Now with a real monster at our door, as terrible as in any science fiction, will we wake up in time? Thanks a lot for a really thoughtful and very valuable presentation. Mike, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Good luck with that cough. Don't forget to wash your hands and wear a mask when you go out. Don't listen to the president. He doesn't know what he's talking about when it comes to COVID-19. Thanks a lot and good evening.
Thank you so much, BJ.
And that's our show for today. We featured Mike Davis's 2020 lecture to UMass Amherst History Distinguished Lecture Series. Thanks to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer-director Melissa Figueroa, editor-engineer Juliana Goda, and Gary Baca in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows, as well as subscribe to the podcast at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. More information on programs and guests are on our Facebook page. That's Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. And you've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening. And check KPFK's fire resource links at kpfk.org. I'm Susie Wiseman.
Support comes from UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting Jerome Ellis on February 22nd at the Nimoy. The globally acclaimed Grenadian-Jamaican-American artist examines stuttering, justice, blackness, disabled speech, and divinity in this arresting reflection on the human experience. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu.
Got an old clunker collecting dust in your driveway? Is old reliable, well, not so reliable? Here's the solution. Support KPFK by donating your old car, truck, or boat. It's easy. Pick up your phone, dial 1-877-573-5286, or just dial 1-877-KPFKI. This is an easy way to help support KPFK. Plus, it's a tax deductible, and we'll pick it up for free.
Hi, this is Sally Kirkland, and you're listening to KPFK, radio powered by the people, fiercely independent, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles.
Good morning and happy Sunday to you. It is the 11 a.m. hour, and we're about to get into background briefings with Ian Masters. And don't forget, Cut to the Chase is now scheduled on Fridays at 7 a.m. with Sylvester Rivers. That's Cut to the Chase every Fridays at 7 a.m. Stay tuned, KPFK.